I'm very lucky to be on the first day of the main conference. One of the things that I've learned from bad past experience is being the afternoon speaker on Friday, not so good. It's very interesting. Conferences like this have always the same effect on me. I look at the program and there's always like 12 talks that I want to see, and they're almost always in 4 time slots, 3 in parallel. The logic of creating the most interesting talks always next to each other, amazing. So every single time when I present, I have this talk that I actually want to attend myself at the same time. So that's why I was joking about Jim Geddes earlier, who's talking about the OLPC right now, which I would have loved to attend. But, so my name is Dirk Hondel. I am the Chief Technologist for Linux and Open Source at Intel. Great title, doesn't mean anything. What I do at Intel is I try to help Intel understand what this open source thing is. It's kind of weird. So there's people writing software, releasing the sources, not trying to get rich. Very odd. 6 years ago when I joined Intel, literally the majority of the company thought exactly that way. The hardware vendors tend not to have an inherent understanding of software to begin with, and certainly not of this very weird world of open source. So Intel hired me to help them figure out what to do in this space. And Intel pays me, and I'm very happy for that. But as you will note during this talk, this is not exactly Intel speaking. So this is much more the open source person talking about what's happening with open source and how to be successful there. So while I'm very grateful that Intel pays me, please do not construe any of what I say here as Intel's opinion, or I'll get in trouble. So how many of you work for hardware vendors? How many of you talk to hardware vendors on a semi-regular basis? How many of you are customers of hardware vendors? Yeah, and those who didn't raise their hands, what are you doing here? So open source has a tremendous impact on hardware vendors. When Linus started, 16 and a half years ago, open source, the word wasn't invented. The world looked very different for them, and it looked actually much easier. You know, there are these software companies. They have a CEO. I can take him out to dinner, and you know, take him on my boat and talk to him about the secret code I want him to include in his software, that basically has this little if statement that says if friendly hardware company go really really fast, else oh well. And you're laughing about this. There is an embarrassing bit of reality in this. But of course, with open source code like this, even if you're trying to win the obfuscated C contest, still will not survive very long. And actually, the embarrassment of submitting code like this is a pretty big deterrent from this to happen. So in today's world, where open source suddenly is massively important to the hardware vendors, that's a problem. So I say open source is massively important. Who of you thinks open source is massively important for hardware vendors? Okay, you're at LCA, stupid question. I gave the same talk at IDF, Intel's Developer Forum, and you'd be surprised how few people in the audience actually raised their hands. The reality is that today billions of dollars, with a large B at the beginning, are being made with hardware that is designed specifically to be used with open source, or that ends up being used with open source software. One of the reasons for that is very simple. About 10% of all money that is being spent on IT in 2008 will be spent by the top roughly dozen of mega data centers. Our friends at Google, Yahoo, MSN, eBay, Amazon, you know all these names. And the reality is that maybe with the exception of the Microsoft data center, everyone else is building these data centers on Linux and on Apache and with a good serving of open source databases. And in use case FreeBSD. So there is a lot of open source involved there. And thankfully, even at the other end, not the, the extremely large system, oh, by the way, top 500 fastest supercomputers in the world, currently half of them are Linux-based. So yes, on the high-end world, Linux is extremely important. But even on the other end, open source is extremely important. About a third of all the wireless access points of these guys here are running Linux. And of course, the XO and the ASUS EPC and a lot of other devices. And my employer is bringing out these mobile internet devices, which are, like this big. I wish I had one, because I can't get one. And they run Linux, the majority. And so Linux is driving a lot of the sales, a lot of what's important to these vendors. Yet, the fact that Linux is running on your device, for most hardware vendors, does not mean that they need to understand open source, and that is scary to me. And what is the reason for that? Anyone venture a guess? If you're a hardware vendor and you don't care about open source? Yeah, someone else is doing the work. It's even worse than that. The penalty for not doing open source is more or less zero. So the amount of money that vendors who don't do open source lose because of that is extremely hard to quantify. I have tried to help good friends of mine working at a different hardware vendor. And since I work for one, it's very hard for me to say who this is. Maybe you can guess it. Try to help them convince their employer to go open source with their drivers. And the employer, like any good company, said, okay, let's do a study. And they did a study of the cost. So how much business are we losing because we don't have open source drivers for our hardware? And the answer was, we are losing about 50,000 units, which translates to, a margin loss of in the order of, $500,000, if you say you make $20 per unit, which does not justify, in the eye of that vendor, the immense cost to embrace open source and change their ways. And that's a big deal, yes?
But is it a net cost?
It is a huge cost. If you are a proprietary hardware vendor, and your lawyers have convinced you that your IP is everything that you own, and you are being told to open up your IP to the world, the first estimate of this cost is, the market capitalization of my company. I'm not joking. Those are the conversations that you'll have. And I'll get back to this in a moment.
What is it, someone who's chicken and egg as well?
I'll get back to that one as well. So what is the incentive for doing open source? If we just came to the conclusion, you're not really losing money by not doing it. You do binary drivers, you have somebody else reverse engineer it for you. You basically tell the people you work with, eat it up, I don't care. And a lot of hardware vendors do. I just came out of John Corbett's talk, and he is always so optimistic that everything is great and all the problems are solved. And I'm like, wow, this is not the world I live in. So the incentives to do this is very simple. Get stuff working. You have a device, you want it to work, it's great to have drivers. The next one is a little harder. The next one is this reputation thingy. So is it a problem if Richard Stallman stands up in front of MIT and says, don't buy from vendor X? I don't know. Is it a problem if the ASUS EPC is released and a week later or 2 weeks later there is all the headlines about them violating the GPL and all the bad press, and of course they immediately realize that they actually didn't intend to do that and fix it. But what stays in people's mind is, oh my God, they violated the GPL. So reputation is a very, very dangerous thing here, because you can damage your reputation both ways. You can damage your reputation by going open source and doing it wrong, or you can damage your reputation by not doing it and enduring the wrath from people like us. The third argument, which we don't hear a lot about, is actually one that is very near and dear to my heart, which is preventing damage. A lot of people don't realize it, but chips actually are really fragile. It is embarrassingly easy to destroy a silicon. It is embarrassingly easy. And especially devices that you know, have, you can play with the frequencies, you can play with the input and output voltages, you can do all kinds of fun stuff. It's very easy to fry these things. And one of my very early experiences with this is when in the early 90s, the leading graphics card was, anybody old enough? Matrox Millennium. Long before that, Matrox Millennium. A fantastic graphic card, no 3D features whatsoever. 2D was barely fast enough to drive a big screen, but back then really, really fast. What was really great about the Matrox cards is that they actually had very good signal quality. So you would get really nice flanks on your RC if you looked at it. And they were one of the first vendors to have the programmable clock chip. So you didn't have just, you know, the five clock frequencies, but you had the crystal on the board. But you actually could program the clock frequencies. And of course, they didn't document this because they wrote the Windows driver, so who cares? So we ended up reverse engineering this. I used to be an x86 developer in a different life. And turns out we got it wrong. And the way we did it meant that as soon as you ran a clock frequency above, if I remember correctly, 67.5 megahertz, not that this turned out to be an important number for me, you were actually running two of the components on this card way beyond their spec, to the effect that you could get this card to go poof inside your computer. Not good. Interestingly enough, it was Matrox who came to us and said, okay, guys, you know, we find you highly annoying and we would love for you to go away, but please don't destroy our cards. Here is how you program them correctly. And in a very odd twist of fate, the gentleman who worked in Matrox developer relations back then, who actually ended up giving me those documentation for a couple of years, was a coworker of mine at Intel. He has now moved on to Microsoft for some reason. So preventing damage is something that, especially with today's hardware, companies think about a lot. Because today's hardware more and more is a symbiosis of software and hardware, and I'll talk about this a little bit later, but it's very important to understand that the tools that hardware companies use to prevent you from doing damage to yourself, because, oh, by the way, these things actually can really explode and really start fires. Doing that is much harder than it seems. So who in this room loves ACPI? Damn, Len Brown isn't in the room. Okay, there's one, thank you, one person. ACPI is a terrible abomination of a spec that is, you know, 907 pages, if I remember correctly, and not a single hardware vendor, I think us included, implements it correctly. What happens if on a state-of-the-art, high-end, you know, extreme edition computer, you boot it without ACPI, you say ACPI off? You are extremely likely to run your computer outside of spec, and as one of the hardware testing sites found out, you can get it to catch fire. So yes, to go back to my initial point, preventing damage is actually one of the reasons why people are willing to go open source. But what actually motivates hardware vendors? I mean, let's face it, it's not us. It's not the reputation, it's not, oh, the good feeling of supporting community. It's dollars, or pounds, or euros, or yen, or whatever. Yuan, I guess, more and more. So they're all in there basically to make a buck. And please never say this with this little, you know, condescension or, you know, looking down at them, because, oh, by the way, I like to get paid. I really want Intel to make money, because I want them to give it to me. So face it, it's the reality. People are in this business to make money. Even the very sweet guys from OLPC are in this to make money, even though Niklas may not want you to think that, but that is the underlying goal. So one of the really hard things, if you want to motivate someone who's in it for money, is that you actually need to be able to impact the money that he makes in order to influence them. And this is where this computer ecosystem is a little difficult for us. Because what happens is, so the silicon vendor, let's call them company A, sells their component, the chip, to company B that makes, let's say, the plug-in card or the motherboard or whatever it is. Company B now takes this component and sells it to the OEM, most likely actually to the outsourced ODM who fabricates the computers for the OEM. So, I mean, Apple doesn't make these things. Fox Pro in China makes these. Now, this company sells to the branded vendor. That company sells to the retailer, and the retailer sells to you. So, remember company A? Those are the guys you need to influence. They never see your money. And oh, by the way, if you say, I am not going to buy an Intel CPU for my next computer, while on some level Intel cares, I think our last quarter was around $11 billion revenue, something like that. The $250 for that CPU are not going to really change the direction of the company. So the question is, how can you actually influence them? How can you make money talk? How can you use this value chain, this chain of people buying from each other, so that each person tells the previous person, oh, by the way, we need to get open source components here. How can you translate what we want into what they want? And it's actually not that hard. It's just it requires a little bit more strategic thinking. So the number one driver for influence is market share. So who is the number one market share operating system for servers? Windows, okay. By installations. I mean, not OS revenue. I'm talking about hardware revenue behind it. Hardware revenue. It's Windows. And if you take number of installations, then Linux is second. If you take dollars, then IBM mainframe is second. Who is the number one market share for desktops? Windows. Who is the number one market share for cell phones? Okay, that's hard. That's like Symbian. That's the Nokia thingy. You notice Linux doesn't really show up in this list a lot. Nevertheless, Linux is important enough for servers, where it has, you know, 25-28% market share, depending on whom you want to believe. It's important enough for servers that in the server space, having conversations with the hardware vendors is relatively easy. I say relatively easy because there are some odd niches where it still is very hard. It tends to be the high-end storage controllers. The guys designing high-end storage controllers are some of my worst case examples. I'll talk about them specifically in a moment. But if you're talking about desktop, mobile, handheld, anything, it is excessively hard to catch people's attention. And this is where we as the consumers come in. I know that most of us buy, you know, actually this is a surprisingly heterogeneous audience. Normally the majority of what you see are the black things, the ThinkPads. And then if you're at an open source event, the number two tends to be the Fruities. And I only see like a couple of Apples. It's surprising, three, okay. And then, of course, it's all the non-branded, the Dells, and the mass market stuff. So when you buy your laptop, most of us end up paying for a copy of an operating system that we didn't want, but the OEM never hears that we actually would have preferred not to pay for it. Yeah. Yes? Yeah. Yes, so I hear that here in New Zealand and Australia in the South Pacific, you are the lucky ones who who actually can actively refuse. It used to be that Germany, where I'm originally from, had a retail chain that basically went head-to-head with Microsoft and started to say every system's available with or without OS. But that's the minority. Most people, it's very hard. Compaq have it on their website for a while, and on some devices they still have it, on some they don't. IBM currently offers, it's HP, I think, offers you free DOS as one of the examples, which is great, because if you click that, then HP's controlling systems realize that you didn't want Windows. That's a very important message. And I'm very thrilled about devices like the EPC, which comes with Linux pre-installed. Next time you buy hardware, think really, really hard about a way to buy hardware that signals to your vendor that you didn't want Windows. I mean, assuming you didn't want Windows. If you wanted Windows, then why are you here? Yes?
So it's that's sort of a contrast to what you were saying before. The chain is so long.
Very good point. So he says it's a contrast to what I said before, that the chain is so long and the message doesn't get passed. The message gets passed as soon as it's loud enough. It's all about volume. So, I mean, even a device like the EPC, which has so far sold about 500,000 devices in 3 months and is expected to hit 3.5 million in 2008, folks, that's 1.5% of all new computers sold. Yes, that's volume. But, oh, by the way, currently the official Gartner number is that Linux is 0.8% on the desktop. And there's just a single computer shipping with Linux, which is going to double this in 2008. So, yes, volume is extremely important. But the interesting thing is that many of us have a megaphone, the thing that they use to yell at people when they're rowing on the river in the morning. When I go running in the morning, I have a hotel down at the Yarra River, and you have these people on the bicycle who are yelling at the rowers. The problem is if you have a megaphone in one hand on the bicycle handle, and you look at this way and you yell at them, it's really hard to look at the stupid runners who are coming at you. It's very dangerous. Anyway, I get distracted. So you have this megaphone yourself, because most of you work for a company, an organization, are in a club, are in some form of organization that does stuff jointly. That could be, your student union, that could be your employer, that could be your bicycling club, your running club, you come up with it. And it is very easy as such a group to A, document how big you are, and B, send a letter to an OEM who doesn't do this today and say, we would love to do a group purchase of these devices. And please be realistic. Think about things that you actually would buy. And let that OEM know that you would only consider them if a version of Linux or an OS, a version without an OS was available. Because the fun thing is, these statistics are very, very carefully monitored. And this information actually ends up on my desk at the end of the day. Well, not technically on my desk, but it ends up in the conversation with Intel's sales force as they talk to that OEM and say, we want to sell you these chips. And the OEM at some point says, you know what, there's a lot of people asking me for Linux. I want to make sure I have this all under control. So there is market share, very important. Voting with your dollars, very important. Education, that's what I do. So, stand up and talk to people. I talk a lot to the OEMs. I talk occasionally even to the retail channel, even though that's kind of hard. I talk certainly to a lot of the component makers, the motherboard makers, the device makers. And if you have a chance to do so, and explain to them why open source is good and why our methodology works and is successful. There is another thing that's very important, which is what Greg KH has started last year, which is helping them. A lot of the vendors, especially in Taiwan, are surprisingly small. And for them, the idea of not only having to do a Windows driver, but also having to do a driver for each of the 223 different flavors of Linux that we use. I think if I do a poll in this room, we find easily 20 different versions of Linux that all of us combined use. Scary. Very scary to a vendor, because they don't understand what this means. They don't understand that once you're in the upstream kernel, you're fine. That is not something that is part of their experience. So helping them, offering them device driver development, offering them, you know, I'll help you if you run into problems, talking to them as you have one-on-one contact, which you actually can have at these events. That's why I asked earlier who's working for hardware vendors, because they send people to these events. And if you see someone with a badge, where's my badge? If you see someone with a badge that says, you know, your favorite silicon vendor on it, talk to them. And tell them, I'm happy to help you. You run into a problem with your kernel, you know, give me a call, I'll debug it for you. This really works. One thing, though, doesn't work, and this is something I'm always very scared about when I give this presentation, which is public calls for boycotts. Because like every person, management in large companies is human. And they really don't like having someone put a gun in their chest and say, do or else. And that rarely ever gets you the goodwill that you actually need to convince them to do the right thing. That is much more likely to get their lawyers at you and talk to you about the potential limitations to your ability to conduct your right to free speech, which, oh, by the way, doesn't exist in all countries. For example, my home country doesn't have a right of free speech. So what I really want to focus on in this presentation is the part of talking to them and helping them. Because the number of problems that they come up with and the number of, let's not call them excuses, let's call them reasons why they're not doing what we want them to do, is actually very, very small. And it's very, very repetitive. It's always the same, you know, 3, 4, 5 things. The number one thing by far is, you know, you're not, this is not important to us. There is no monetary value for us. It costs us money to do this. That's where the offer to help comes in, and that's where education comes in. But that's something that in an individual conversation is very hard to overcome. But a couple of the others actually are easy to overcome. The next most frequent reason that you hear is there are no docs. There is no documentation. That may seem silly to you. But the reality is that most chips produced today do not even have a programmer's manual. 10 years ago, that was completely unthinkable. I mean, every chip would come with a programmer's reference manual because how else would you have somebody write something for it? Today, that is absolutely not the case. The majority of chips that are produced by a very small team of people that includes the firmware writer and that includes one or two software guys who then end up writing the drivers. And it's literally a common occurrence that the driver author would sit down with the guy who designed the chip and the guy who wrote the firmware and say, you know what, I thought when I set this bit to 1 it would do that, and it doesn't. Why is that? And there is no one taking the time to actually write a formal programmer's reference manual. Without trying to embarrass my own employer, getting a company the size of Intel to create viable programmers' reference manuals has proven to be an impressive challenge. I think we're getting better. We are going to announce a few releases of PRMs hopefully soon. But suffice to say, there is a lot of stuff inside Intel that today does not have manuals. And we are a pretty big company. If you're a smaller company, the likelihood that the documentation exists is far smaller. So what's the answer to that? What's the answer when you talk to people? Well, the answer that I taught Intel about and that Intel has been pretty good about the last 3 years or so is you can do documentation by proxy. Documentation by proxy is that you write a simple device driver that uses the main features of your hardware and publish this in open source as a reference implementation. And oh, by the way, many of the drivers that we publish today, at the time when we publish them, could politely be called simple or buggy and broken, but that's not so nice. So it is extremely important to realize that writing an open source driver that you document as well as you can and that you give out to people is not quite as good as documentation, but is a huge step in the right direction. Or to turn this conversation around, you, the hardware vendor, well, I'm talking to you as if you were them and I am, never mind. So the hardware vendor does not have to actually write the driver. No one expects the hardware vendor to write high quality open source drivers. Intel kind of tries to, but that's besides the point. That is not what a hardware vendor needs to do. All you need to do is enable this community to actually do that. Because the community will happily engage and write the drivers. I mean, I'm sure that many of you will happily engage and write the drivers. There is a large list of volunteers that Greg maintains. There is a very efficient method to get these people together by simply posting on Slashdot and saying, we are looking for people who are writing driver for our cool device. And it's amazingly easy. So documentation by proxy basically means you take a couple of trusted people, whatever trusted means in this context, and allow them access to the few people inside of a company that actually know how this thing works. So very similar to what I talked about earlier, to the Windows driver guys sitting together with the two people who actually know how this device works. Now that's scary. Oh my God, allowing somebody from the outside access to your most valuable possession, which is your key engineers, is very, very scary. So that's why you try to have this proxy in between. You restrict this to one or two trusted developers. And this is totally childish. We agreed with one business group to a cap how many times a quarter we are allowed to ask these guys a question. Excuse me? But yeah, whatever makes them happy, I don't care. We haven't gone to 50% of this cap in the conversation so far. So documentation by proxy is not what we really want. We want nice, you know, PRMs, programmers reference manuals. But if they don't exist, that's a good step. The next thing that you will hear a lot are IP concerns. Now, I am not a lawyer. I don't even play one on TV. But if company critical IP is revealed by explaining to people how to use your device, something's wrong with your definition of IP. So this is like saying, okay, I'm a car manufacturer. I'm going to patent that turning this wheel this way will make my car go to the left. And I'll prevent you from doing this. I'm not sure if this is a very good strategy for a car manufacturer. I don't think it's a good strategy for a silicon company. But it's a conversation you need to have with them. You need to explain to them that what is the value that they own, what is their IP, their intellectual property. And by the way, that's much more than just patents. I mean, that's copyrights, trade secrets. That's ways in which they do things. But the actual value lies in this, by the way, in this order, manufacturing. And this is definitely by far the most important thing that Intel does, is our fabs. You know, a fab costs you $5 billion. And the stuff that goes in there is really, really proprietary, and we don't share this with the world. Then it's the VLSI layout of your chip. And oh, by the way, you don't disclose this when you explain how the registers work, how you program the chip. That's the algorithms used on the chip. As I just said, you don't disclose that if you just say, write a bit one there and it turns on, you know, the signal or something. So this is something where you simply need a conversation with people to understand the difference of explaining to the software world how to use the device versus somebody else being able to make the device. Sounds very simple. Everyone agrees? This is, I believe, the hardest conversation that I have, whether it is in-house with Intel or whether it's when I'm talking to other people. This is the hardest conversation. Convincing hardware people who believe that everything in the world rotates around them and that it's all about their IP. Convincing them that releasing a programmer's manual is not infringing on their IP is unbelievably hard. And please, if you get the chance to do this, be patient. Telling them that they're stupid usually doesn't help. I've tried. And I have 3-year-old twins. And so when you raise children, you can use the skills that it takes to convince hard to vendors. Small sentences, easy concept, repeat, repeat, repeat. And it is pretty amazing that you talk to very smart people, and you talk to people, you know, who have a PhD in EE and are a senior fellow at, say, Intel, and you try to explain to them that actually you want people to know how to use this device because they may do something cool with it. And the example that I use is one that usually wins the conversation inside Intel. In 1991, two gentlemen from Intel, one is now a senior vice president, one is a senior fellow, published a book about programming the 386. No holds barred, everything is documented how to use this chip. That's the book that Linus used to start writing on Linux. To start writing Linux, no on in the middle. And so my argument is, if we had not released this 15 years ago, the, I don't know, $N billion a year we make with devices running Linux today wouldn't be there. If Linus had asked you in 91, can I have all the proprietary documentation how to program your chips, what would have been your answer? And they say, of course, yes. I say, okay, so if I ask you today, can I please have proprietary documentation how to program today's chips, what's your answer? They usually say no, but you get the idea. Yes? Were people able to hear him? So the comment was, he's puzzled because it seems entirely obvious that the hardware and the software are separate. And my comment to you is, yeah, to us. The problem, don't want to make a George Bush joke, but I mean, somewhere there are weapons of mass destruction and Saddam Hussein is exactly the same story, right? It's painfully obvious to us that there weren't any, and still there's a war going on. I'm going to get to this, Dave. Yeah. So, in general, absolutely. And it gets complicated, as I said earlier, with very modern chip devices. So there's a small addendum that I have to make to this. And that is the issue of regulatory concerns, or often called major pain in my butt. Because in their infinite wisdom, the regulators in almost all countries have very specific ideas of what they allow you to do and not allow you to do. For example, how strong a signal you can send from your computer in the 2.4 gigahertz band is something that basically every country on this planet has very strict ideas about. And today's devices, which is where David was going, actually tend to be combinations of software and hardware. So there is a lot of functionality that is actually in hardware that is locked away that you can't mess with. And there is more and more functionality in software. And the two top contenders for this prize are graphics and wireless devices. And one of the big innovations that Intel keeps talking about at our developer conferences is the so-called software radio. So you have a little device that can be a Bluetooth device, a WLAN, a WiMAX, a GSM, whatever you want, any wireless device. And it can switch between those different characteristics so quickly, millions of times a second, that you actually can have on the very same one hardware device two different radio connections at different frequencies using different protocols at the same time. And of course, all this is done in software. And of course, regulators think that they have a say what happens there, which, oh, by the way, according to the opinion of Intel's lawyers, precludes us from doing this in open source. And, oh, by the way, I think our lawyers are right. I mean, not right in the sense that I think this is morally correct, but legally it's definitely correct. To the extent that, oh, by the way, if we were to document this in open source, I am certain that we would be, our permission to sell these devices definitely in the US and in the EU would immediately be withdrawn, which would cost us a few billion dollars. Talk about money talks. So that stuff is not going to happen in open source. Right now, we all had, and most of you will know this, the famous binary blob in the Intel wireless driver. In order to work around the upsetness of the open source community, we, the open source team, instead of writing open source stuff, rewrote the firmware for our wireless chips. So we had 5 people learn how the firmware is programmed on our wireless chips and put all this crap into the firmware, remove the stuff that used to be in the firmware, some of the nice WPA and WEP stuff, and did that in an open source driver instead. Yes? Because all hardware is designed for Windows, we talked about this earlier. In Windows, you don't have this problem. You can have everything in the driver. So you put in the firmware what you think is most important to have in the firmware to be optimized for your device. Because, every element, especially the encryption stuff, if you can have it done as well as possible for your device and can prevent any part of the software stack to mess with it, you can improve the performance of your device, which makes it more attractive to sell it. So since everything is designed for Windows, the thought that you need to have this specific, the regulatory sensitive part of the code on firmware is not something that is natural to the designers of devices. And oh, by the way, even though Intel is certainly, I think, one of the open source enlightened companies, the trend goes more and more in this direction. There is more and more in software that has a regulatory impact and that will get us in trouble. And this brings us, it's almost the same thing to the next fear, which is the competitive fear. Oh my God, my competitor is going to see what I do, and that comes back to graphics. Because in graphics, there is a lot of stuff where it's not only the question, so how do I tell the graphics engine to render a surface here or a dot or anything. But there is a lot in the drivers that There's a lot in the driver that optimizes that and that actually uses algorithms that companies spend millions of dollars on developing. Algorithms that are A, software, and B, part of the driver. And that people are extremely hesitant to have anybody take a look at. So when we are doing the drivers for our graphics chip, we literally don't use a lot of the features of the hardware because these features only make sense with those very odd algorithms used in the Windows driver. We cannot use those algorithms, so those features aren't interesting to us. So we use more simplistic features in the hardware and re-implement publicly visible algorithms, which is an insane duplication of effort. But the reality is there is true intellectual property, true value in these algorithms in the drivers, and you're not going to get companies to give this up, especially not in a cutthroat market like graphics. I mean, that is one of the worst, I think. Oh, that is very factual.
I agree. I understand. I'm very familiar with this attitude from the graphics design, graphics card company. My question is if you feel that the conclusion actually makes any sense whatsoever.
Yes.
Firstly, I think it's a viewing it way too much as a zero-sum game. And if there was a bigger picture view of these companies that.
Yeah, so to repeat the question is, do I believe that this is actual true? Is this is this in the big picture correct, that there is stuff in software that it's worth hiding? And I'm extremely sad to say that I spent a couple of months together with Keith Packard and a few other very smart people sitting down with the driver authors. And yes, there are things in the drivers that really are special and that really use things that we would not want the competitors to see, because we believe that we have a nice edge in several of these algorithms, and we can show this in benchmarks. If we use the public algorithms to do the same thing, suddenly our hardware is 50% slower.
Isn't this the same kind of discussion that's been had in so many other hardware fields that are now open source and just taken for granted?
No. So this is not this is not the discussion about drivers. This is the discussion about algorithms that are used that 5 years ago would have been part of your silicon. 5 years ago, this level of algorithm would all have been implemented on silicon, and you would simply say go. And today, that isn't the case anymore. So this is why the reality has changed there. But the thing that I'm trying to say is, it is still possible to develop open source drivers for this, because the underlying logic still, the way you program this, is not IP. The argument is all about, can I open source the existing driver? So there is a large graphic card vendor that is not us, that thankfully is going open source. And I'm thrilled and I'm so happy that they're doing this. But they are not open sourcing their existing drivers. Instead, they are releasing documentation. They are telling the open source community, knock yourself out.
That's not so much because of protecting the IP, but the cost of actually vetting whether or not they can process the legal costs. And then the procedural costs are the same, so it's easier to start from scratch.
I believe that not to be true. Yes, there's a lot of code in these drivers that will never see the light of day. There are so many, I have no idea what's first. Won't the competitors reverse engineer it anyway? In this cutthroat world, especially of graphics, where a generation till you go to the next release is 6 months, 9 months on the low end, anything that slows them down is pure dollars. So giving them the sources versus them sitting down with a debugger and figuring out, absolutely worth it to the companies. Not an argument you're going to win.
Does that mean that the open source implementation is very unlikely to back?
Yes. In several cases, it does indeed mean that the open source drivers are indeed a lot slower than the proprietary drivers. Interestingly enough, we managed, and I can't say where, in one case where we internally were prevented from using the proprietary secret sauce, we managed to out-program the secret sauce, which was very embarrassing, to the team of 210 engineers who maintained the other code versus our five. Yeah. Yeah.
You talk to Mad Dog, and he'll give you story after story, including in graphics, where we've gone through the exact same thing historically. People go, oh no, my code is so hot shit, I can't share it, because it has so much more value.
Yes, and again.
Time and time again, it's been shown this is not an argument that actually stands up to any real scrutiny.
And I can't show you the code. If I could, it would be wrong. I actually know of two specific cases where we are very certain that this is true, and where we have no doubt that the code that has been developed is really special. And it's very specific for the way the hardware is implemented. And
I'm sure that code is special. I'm not saying that code isn't special, but the value that gets destroyed in trying to protect little bits of specialness usually is outweighed.
Yes, big picture that may be true, but for the individual device it isn't. Yeah. Guys, I have like 5 minutes left and I want to get to like three more points if I can. And then I'll be happy to have you yell at me. So there are a few things I want you to go home with after this presentation. The number one and the by far most important one is encourage the right behavior. We, as the open source community, need to encourage the right behavior. What does that mean? There needs to be more of a penalty for doing the wrong thing. We are so willing to go out there and reverse engineer and to develop drivers on our own dime for companies that don't want to help us. That is fundamentally stupid. I don't say this because I work for Intel. I say this because if you think this through, you working on your dime to fix a problem that a company is too arrogant or too stupid to deal with, so you spend your own time and money to fix their problem, even though they tell you they don't want to help you, that's dumb. Sorry. No personal offenses, but be very careful of the unintended consequences of your actions. Because the only way you're going to get the vendors to change the tune, the only way you get people to be more willing to provide documentation by proxy, or even drivers, if they understand that the alternative is you don't get the design win. And that, oh, by the way, is the worst thing ever that can happen to a hardware team. And that is what changes perception. And this is an example that thankfully I can say who it is. Intel released Centrino 4.5 years ago. And when Intel released Centrino, that's the combination of wireless, whatever. You all know what it is. When we released Centrino, this was Windows only, no Linux drivers. I was an Intel employee, and I was I was having interesting discussions with these people for a long time. 12 months later, a major OEM told us that they were creating a new SKU, a new product line that would require Linux. And oh, by the way, if there aren't open source drivers, Intel was not allowed to participate in the bidding for this product. So in the words of a salesperson, you are going to lose this design win. And within 3 days, I had a senior vice president at Intel say, absolutely, we want open source drivers. What do I need to do to make this happen? So please be very careful with the unintended consequences of your acts. Understand that these companies are not against you personally, even though it may seem so sometimes. They are not against your methodology or having a discussion with you about technology or philosophy, for that matter. For them, it's a money decision. This is all about money. And as much as many of us say, ah, that's icky, that's the reality, that's how life works. And if you want to convince them, if you want to win this argument, you need to speak in a language that they understand. So, oh, by the way, I give this very same presentation every few weeks inside Intel, and my examples sound very different. My examples are about dollars, about units, about volumes, about margin, about impact on future markets. I sound like I actually knew something about economy, which is ridiculous. But hey, it's all about speaking language that they understand. Finally, engage, listen. Talk to people and listen to them. Listen very carefully what they tell you. And as you just say, they may be wrong, but you need to listen to them. Offer to help, offer to educate, and repeat, repeat, repeat. More questions? Dave. There's a mic right next to you, by the way.
Yeah, I've had long discussions dealing with Andy, and I had a small hand in the Intel open sourcing at the time as well. And you are right in that area. I think you're wrong with the don't piss off hardware vendors. It doesn't matter. Piss them off. It actually doesn't matter to the open source community. Eventually, if money is good enough for them, they will come around and find the open source community. So
careful. No, there are two different things. I said boycotts don't work.
Boycotts don't work, but implementing drivers on their hardware or doing anything like that, it may cost a person. It's because the open source developers don't have time and don't really care about the money. Most of them, these guys are students and they like doing this for their fun, and they're doing a great job. And it doesn't change NVIDIA's mind one little bit.
But that's exactly what I'm, you're misunderstanding my point. My point is The fact that there is a project to reverse engineer and to create this driver is reducing the likelihood of them changing their mind. This is not about pissing them off.
No, that's actually not.
This is reducing the likelihood because
basically
the fact that Mark Shuttleworth from Ubuntu says, oh, look, with this project, I now can have open source for NVIDIA, means that the biggest thing possible, Dell saying, we do Ubuntu, NVIDIA, if you want to be in this Dell design win, you have to have an open source driver, just went away.
No, you're wrong.
Absolutely.
Because, what happens there is, and this is what's actually going to happen, because it's what's happening with AMD, is they will push, Dell will start shipping Ubuntu with the Nouveau driver, but with no support path. Then Dell will say, NVIDIA, we don't want you to support your binary driver, we need you to support this driver, because this is the driver we ship on the hardware. And the only way to get certification of Dirk, I know where I am here. The only way to get certification of RHEL and SLES and all these things is out-of-the-box certification is without the binary driver. So the only way that will happen is the pressure will get put on them to do, we need to certify with all these things our customers will buy them, and NVIDIA will eventually, it happened with a network driver. The open source
network
driver.
So David, you're entitled to your opinion, that's just fine. The reality is the decision in AMD to release the drivers had nothing to do with the existence of
No, it was to do with money. But the problem was money was pushed in from other companies.
No. We have two different opinions. And since I'm the presenter, in this presentation, you will take away that actually this is harmful. David is presenting on Friday.
Yes.
On Friday, David will teach you how reverse engineering is good. And then you can make up your mind. I have like 60 more seconds. Yes.
Just with the proprietary bits of code.
There's a mic for you.
With the proprietary bits of code that were in each of the graphics chips and drivers and things like that, it's pretty safe to assume that each of the hardware vendors for the graphics drivers all have their own bits of proprietary code that they're proud of, that it perform better or whatever. So how much does that actually affect the market? You know, how many people purchase it? How many people are purchasing these cards because they do a specific operation in, you know, 1/10 of the time of, say, the NVIDIA card that's around there? And, you know, if people aren't actually purchasing it for there, or the majority of money isn't coming in for that specific instance, why do they care?
So you're applying logic and rational arguments to a marketing discussion. That's very hard. So the marketing discussion is about, my proprietary driver contains secret sauce that will make you be able to kill your opponent faster in Doom. That's the marketing message, and that's why people buy cards. Just like we had in the keynote this morning, it's about the perception of being better, not about the reality of being better. And that's the issue. Because if your driver is open source, then claiming that your new driver is so much better than anything else just went away. This is the problem. The problem is not the reality, just like we had the discussion here in the front. The problem is not the reality that long-term you can maintain this differentiation. The problem is that you are able to create the perception of differentiation, and that's what helps in the marketing arena. It really does. Because they have the better driver. Go to the graphic card testing sites, and you will literally have pages and pages of saying, and for Unreal Tournament 3, the 726B5 driver from ATI has this great feature that allows you to what? I mean, seriously. Yes. According to the marketing people who make the decision, a lot. So here in front. Last question.
You mentioned two reasons for that companies don't release source code for their hardware. One is protection of IP, and the other is that they don't want the burden of maintaining two sets of drivers. The experience I have and stories I hear from other people is that there are some other reasons. The first is that often when they do board bring-ups and for qualifying hardware, they do write Linux drivers first of all to qualify the hardware, then they throw those away once they've proven the hardware and write the Windows drivers. And another reason they don't release it is because the code that was written in the first place is so bad it would never make mainstream kernels that they fear that if they release it, people will laugh at them.
So the first part, I think I work very closely with a lot of different hardware vendors. I have never heard this story. I can tell you an embarrassing secret, which will soon not be a secret anymore. Most bring up is done on DOS. So most new chips are brought up with DOS and DOS drivers, because that's what people think is the easiest to do. And as of the Nehalem generation, that's no longer possible because of an odd feature that we've changed. So now Linux will be part of the bring up. But the reality is, I'm not aware of a single company that actually uses Linux as their first bring up OS if they aren't an active supporter of Linux.
I'm talking more Taiwan peripheral companies.
No, I was in Taipei at IDF last fall, and I've spoken to at least 25 companies, and I have never heard this. Anyway, thank you very much for your attention. Enjoy afternoon tea.